Number four, while people are coming in, I'm going to read two pages of a modern little scripture. Many of you know her work, and this one applies to today's theme, because I've talked a little bit about the sacred and the varieties of ways in which we pay attention to the sacred or dull it. And as I say, you know her. This is Annie Dillard and Holy the Firm, pages 57, 58. She's writing out of Cascades. There is one church here, so I go to it. On Sunday mornings, I quit the house and wander down the hill to the white frame church in the firs. On a big Sunday, there might be 20 of us there. Often, I'm the only person under 60, and it feels as though I'm on an archaeological tour of Soviet Russia. The members are of mixed denominations. The minister is a Congregationalist and wears a white shirt. The man knows God. Once, in the middle of a long pastoral prayer of intercession for the whole world, for the gift of wisdom to its leaders, for hope and mercy to the grieving and pained, succor to the oppressed, and God's grace to all. In the middle of this, he stopped and burst out, "Lord, we bring you these same petitions every week." After a shocked pause, he continued reading the prayer. Because of this, I like him very much. "Good morning," he says after the first hymn and invocation, startling me witless every time. We all shout back, "Good morning." The church women all bring flowers for the altar. They haul in arrangements as big as hedges of wayside herbs in season and flowers from their gardens, huge bunches of foliage and blossoms as tall as I am and vases the size of tubs, and the altar still looks empty, irredeemably linoleum and beige. We had a wretched singer once, a guest from a Canadian congregation, a hulking blonde girl with chopped hair and big shoulders who wore tinted spectacles and a long lacy dress and sang, grinning to faltering accompaniment, an entirely secular song about mountains. Nothing could have been more apparent than that God loved this girl. Nothing could more surely convince me of God's unending mercy than the continued existence on earth of the church in the face of this. The higher Christian churches, Catholic, Anglican, Lutheran types, the higher Christian churches, where if anywhere I belong, come at God with an unwarranted air of professionalism, with authority and pomp as though they knew what they were doing, as though people in themselves were an appropriate set of creatures to have dealings with God. I often think of the set pieces of liturgy as certain words which people have successfully addressed to God without their getting killed. In the high churches, they saunter through the liturgy like mohawks along a strand of scaffolding who've long since forgotten their danger. If God were to blast such a service to bits, the congregation would be, I believe, genuinely shocked. But in the low churches, you expect at any moment. That's the beginning of wisdom. She has a touch about the sacred here when she says that the liturgy, in a sense, is a set of words from people who have successfully addressed God without getting killed. Because, as you'll recall, throughout the week, I'm trying to suggest that the apprehension of the sacred is not easily domesticated or domesticable or rendered cozy. It frightens and it lures. Fear not and come unto me are both words of the sacred, and we try to keep both of these in some sort of tension. So today is worship, public and private, more of the public than of the private, it turned out as I worked on it. Last night I was acutely aware that in talking about healing, I was talking to people who in their own lives, many of you being therapists and in healing professions, in pastoral work, or in constant commitment to each other as suffering and hoping human beings, certainly had to know immediately more about the subject than anybody who would get in front of you would, and certainly that would include me, who tells stories about people who do those things. And so this morning I also have to be highly aware that many of you in your prayer life, I'm sure, are virtuosos in a way that I wouldn't claim to be, and many of you are leaders of worship and bring your talents in music, in art, or whatever, in ways that would be far beyond what I would do. I tell the stories of those who do, being an historian, teller of stories of the church, and in a way a theologian, namely someone who reflects on the language and experience of the church. It is, as in a sense, a fellow lay person that I would speak, but as someone who cares greatly about the culture, a profane culture in which the sacred doesn't often appear, and where the graffitis grow and the obscenities grow, And someone who cares about the life of the church and its pulse, I do want to relate this. And you can't walk in here this summer with the theme that we're treating so literally, listen to the sacred, without realizing that for most of us, most of the time, the most consistent access to the sacred is in our personal prayer and in our corporate, congregational, communal worship, or in the experimental worship forms in which many of us participate in small groups or whatever it might be. And I want to say some good things today about re-stimulating the sense of the sacred in the way that Annie Dillard talks about it, remembering that the liturgy is the language of people who address God and didn't get killed. Remember, it's always, if you see my face, you cannot live, that the holy is somehow threatening as well as alluring. And when we talk that language, again, I say there is great risk. I said on Monday morning, did Holden Village, did the Wees, did the people who plan this theme, whoever they are, know what they have a hold of, because it is so risky and so dangerous. For example, what I didn't do last night, the microphone being 7 minutes late, was two paragraphs on the risks of talking about suffering the way I was, reminding us that death is the limit of life and all of our therapies and alternative therapies can't do away with it, is really a reflection of the fact that we also realize that life is suffering. Buddhism is about nothing but living in a world in which we try to find a way to relate to it. My historian, Jakob Burckhardt, says Christianity is suffering. And we know that's high risk. Dorothea Sully, who's been here sometimes, has written a book called Suffering, in which she treats only suffering of the sort that humans inflict. I'm going to talk about that tomorrow on Justice and the Sacred. And therefore, all of her energy goes into it, and she doesn't like to talk about suffering too much because it can mean that we think that we should choose suffering, or we should be content with suffering. And as a woman, she is highly mindful of the fact that much biblical language, much church language, has been used to tell people to be content with the suffering when a lot could be done through encountering injustice. I go with it as far as it goes, but what always strikes me is that so much suffering is not humanly caused. Whether or not you built the berms or the levees along the Mississippi every 500 years, it's going to do things. And whether or not you do all the right thoughts and thinking and all the right prayers and acting, you're going to die. And whether you follow all the regimens of good health or not, you may increase your odds, and yet unbidden things happen, as they did to Arthur Frank, the author of At the Will of the Body that I was quoting last night. Well, what's today's risk? If to talk about suffering may lead to the risk of people thinking that Christianity is to be an enhancement of suffering instead of a struggle, so too talking about the sacred as that which, in a certain sense, because it is other and beyond, in effect puts us in our place, what does that do to the very profound human need that we're discerning late in this century to value ourselves and value ourselves highly? There are seminars and talks here this week on how to value ourselves more highly. Any of you who have brought up, or any of you who ever were an adolescent, can remember those horrible years, horrible. I'd love to live any year of my life over again except those years. Because who am I, right? I can remember walking into high school gym, 1,500 people there, and I'd have a pimple here, and I was sure that everybody in the room is looking at this worm that's crawling in from Nebraska, right? Who are we? And we have learned a great deal that you can't expect a lot of people unless they have some measure of it. And just about the time that every measure of psychology and self-help and self-esteem and health, self-healing come along, we come into a place where we say that worship, among other things, reminds us of our limits. So that's the thing that we have to deal with so carefully today. You may read yourself into it in various ways. One of my favorite cartoons has a 5'7.5", bald, 65-year-old, bespectacled man standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon next to a very large, prepossessing, authoritative, sure-of-herself woman, and she's looking at him in the canyon and says, "Makes you feel very insignificant, doesn't it?" And that can be an easy corruption of what the sense of the sacred is supposed to do to us in some of the dimensions of worship. makes you feel very insignificant, and yet you're the people that we say are God's creation. You're the people that we say are of the race that God honored enough to enter it in Jesus Christ. You are the people that one of my favorite political thinkers says have the Christian gift of realizing what the exalted individual is because of the identification with creation and redemption. And now we put you in our place. That's my tension, and I love those things. And I might blow it, but at least you know what I'm trying to do. Deal with the sacred as that which is tremendous, shattering, threatening, and at the same time beguiling, seducing, alluring, and comforting. What good is that? Why do we worship? There was a great German theologian, I'll give you his name, he won't sound very German to you, Romano Guardini, made his way across the Alps to Munich at least. Romano Guardini, who's given, for me, it's lasted 45 years, I haven't thought of a better definition of what worship does or how you characterize worship. Worship, he says, is zwecklos, aber doch sinnvoll. It is pointless, but significant. It is pointless, but significant. Most of life is pointed toward the paycheck, toward the fulfillment of our ambitions, toward the piling up of our family heritages, toward the care of an economy and the country. It's pointed. It's practical. Worship is pointless. It doesn't produce. It doesn't manufacture. There aren't new goods at the end of it. And there's no way to easily convert it into pointedness and practicality. I know of a Bible college that in its music department would advertise, yes, you'll learn to play Haydn and Beethoven and Scarlatti and all that. And that bothered them a great deal because these were the world's music. But it was justified by the fact that you would no doubt get manual dexterity and you could be better typists on the mission field for having done this. Or you could play Beethoven because then you could learn to sing the born-again songs. Sharp or flat didn't make a lot of difference because the Holy Spirit honors all keys and all registers, etc. They were looking for a point, forgetting that one of the best things they could do was to be pointless, namely to take the people in a mission field and get them away from the pointedness of life. In this sense, everyone who studies worship seriously says that worship has dimensions of it that are filling the role in life something like play or making love. Ballet, there it goes, and it's over. It's just over. The curtain goes up, lights are on, you get all sweaty, and lights go down, and it's over. Some great ballet people wouldn't even allow films of their ballet to be made because you can't reproduce experience. You ever try to go home from a great service after the divine elemental roar of the organ and the sermon work and the hymns work and the choir work, and you go home and tell the slug of beds, boy, you should have been there. It really was good today. They exist for their own sake. They are pointless. Now, tomorrow I'm going to talk about pointedness. I'm going to argue that the sacred has a great deal to do with the practical living of our lives. Action. Justice, if you will. I'm not going to talk about that at all today. If it slips in, it's by mistake. Rousseau once said, you can expect my thoughts to be consistent with each other, but you can't expect me to assert them all at the same time. So if you just leave here today thinking there's too much pointlessness, go home and read Isaiah 58, tomorrow's text, and you'll see that Yahweh, through Isaiah 2, doesn't have a lot of interest in liturgical reform or the length of prayers or fasting. There's something else in mind. I don't think these are in contradiction, but you can't do them both the same moment. Worship, the contact with the sacred through worship, I'm arguing, is pointless but significant. Maybe nothing tells us more about what we are and who we are as humans. Nothing does more to draw people into the believing community, or if done badly, to alienate them from it. This is often the first contact. Today, if you want to evangelize, the best shot you have is to invite people to a warm and rich worshiping community where you hope something of what brought you there carries. And how hard it is if that isn't manifest. Robert Coles, I quoted yesterday, the Harvard psychiatrist, said that You should bring people to church. He's an Episcopalian, and he's aware of the statistic. They did a survey on when did an Episcopalian last invite someone to church. It comes out statistically to the average Episcopalian invites somebody to church every 29 years, which is probably high for Presbyterian and Lutheran and United Methodist and so on. But he says if you do get them there, and they immediately sense that the people there are sensing the presence of God in their worship, you don't have a lot of trouble getting them back a second time. It can happen in a tent revival, it can happen in Chartres Cathedral, but there has to be some sense of the presence. If not, it's over. It may not be in the form that they'll permanently seek, but they'll at least be allured because the sense of the sacred is here. It is significant. It signs things. We talk of signs of health, warning signs, danger signs, zoning signs. Signals that people emit, and worship is the place where we emit the signals that suggest that we want to be in range of the sacred. Now, the sacred is not exactly the same thing as a revelation of God. In worship, we try to enact it, let's say, weekly, or at Holden Village, nightly. And not all of these are revelations in the sense that we think of the scholars of religion talk about. Hierophanies, the appearance of the holy in a decisive way. Epiphany, the showing forth, the manifesting of light, the appearances. I don't think my wrestling is on a par with Jacob's wrestling. And if any of you were inspired to think of the call you get, I doubt whether they're going to write books about our call the way we write about Abraham called from Ur of the Chaldees to be the leader of a people. I've been in a temple a lot of times, and it might still happen, but I've not had six-winged cherubim come with hot coal and do the works so that at Eucharist forever after people have to sing thrice holy, holy, holy. And I haven't plowed, but I've hoed, and I've not had Amos's call. I'd like to think I'm close. I hope you understand, is both autobiographical and generic. It's M.E.M., and it's, I think, all of us are saying that we do have experiences, no doubt. Most of us do. And in worship, we try to set up a circumstance in which these things happen, but we don't likely put them on the same par. God, who has spoken in sundry and diverse manners through the prophets, has spoken now to us through the Son, Jesus Christ, once and for all. My office at the University of Chicago is right next door to that of David Tracy. Some of you know that name? A lot of people think he's as high-powered a Catholic theologian as we have today. We've done some joint teaching. The students say that he says the profound things and I translate them into English. and I get a lot of my theology from what seeps under the door from their osmosis and capillary action, articulate, whatever, you get these things. And one thing I've learned from him is the notion of the classic. We have literary figures here who could tell you a lot more about classics than I can, but what I take from it, and I translate into English, is a classic is an event or a text of decisive and genius character, which, once it has made its point, has done so with such power that you can never get behind it again. You can repudiate it. You can disagree with it. I never meet an Orthodox Freudian anymore, but you can't get back behind Freud. You aren't going to find many people who are Marxist anymore, except in tenured sociology departments in American universities. But you can't get behind Marx. The notion that something of one's social class tells something about one's idea system and so on, I've always argued the church extension boards are very Marxist. They analyze what's the income group of a community before they decide whether the church should be Pentecostal or Episcopalian. They're Marxist. You can't get behind it once it's there. You can be a creationist, but you can't get behind Darwin. There are no Orthodox Darwinians today. They're neo-Darwinians, they're pseudo-Darwinians, they're post-Darwinians, but his name is in there along the way. A classic in the Christian tradition is Jacob wrestling with the angel, and then we wrestle. Abraham getting called, and we being called. Isaiah having the gift of holiness, and we in our worship trying to reenact something of it. The classic event is the original baptism and the giving of the Lord's Supper. And then we tell the story and we move into that setting. So I'm not saying that contact with the sacred is the same as the decisive, fresh revelation of God. But there seems to be no better way to be in range of these revelations than to position ourselves there where the sacred is to occur. There's a Hasidic Jewish story that I think gives us some sense of this. I was once inspired by it enough to write a book drawing on a title from it. Some of you may know the Hasidic movement was founded by a rabbi named the Baal Shem Tov. And as they tell the story, they tell the story that this founding rabbi of the movement would often have a problem too big for himself. And so he would go to the woods, to a particular place thus made holy, sacred. He would light a fire, he would say a prayer, and he would get an answer, and it was done. And they tell the story of the second generation. The new rabbi says, the fire we can no longer light, but the place we can know, and the prayer we can know. And he would go and say it, and it was done. Well, you can picture the third generation says, the fire we can no longer light, the place we can no longer know, but the prayer we can say, and it was done. And say Martin Buber and Gershom Scholem and the other great analysts of that in the modern world you say the fire we can no longer light, the place we can no longer know, the prayer we no longer can say, but we can profit from telling the story. I wrote a book called The Fire We Can Light, because while I'm a storyteller, I observe around the world there are a lot of people in worship who are having very immediate experiences. The boom in Pentecostalisms in Latin America and Africa, and to some extent in North America. The revival of Hasidic and mystical Judaisms. The recovery of mysticisms and meditation in the Catholic and mainstream Protestant traditions are all signs of people for whom worship is not merely the story that once upon a time somebody knew a place and knew a prayer, and by retelling it we get something. I believe we do get something by retelling the story. By the way, Walter Kaufman, a famous Princeton agnostic professor, always said you should add a fifth generation. Now it is a subject of literary critics who say that's a characteristic Jewish way of telling the story as opposed to a Christian way of telling the story or whatever. The fire we can light. That is, somehow or other, we put ourselves in circumstances where the effort is made to have a sense again of the presence that Robert Coles talks about. There's no single way. Be fun to go around this room, and maybe we'll even finish in time to do so, and talk about some of the moments when some of you had something like this. For me, Taizé, some of you ever been there? To see these young people coming over the hills on Monday morning with their knapsacks from all over Europe, all over the world, to no specific set form, a daily Christian liturgy, but people of many faiths are there. Wow. Or an ecumenical institute at Basse, where you say immediate prayers out of South Africa and out of Korea. It's happened in caves. The young people, often happens at a summer camp, campfire. It happens in Chartres Cathedral. Some of you have been in the military, and it happens with a rickety little hand organ and a little bit of table just before you go into battle and you have communion. Sometimes it happens in the little white church that Annie Dillard writes about, where it's all linoleum and beige, and then the choir, if it exists, sings flat. But it can happen anywhere. But attentive people do what they can to take it extremely seriously. If we went around this place this week and tried to think of all the ways, you could see why one of the things I can't do today is describe what normative worship ought to look like. I know, but I ain't going to tell you. That is, we know we come from so many backgrounds, so many aesthetic interests, so many congregational experiences, that it's hard to prescribe. Don't know if she's here, but last night I'm talking to a seminarian-to-be, Catholic parent, Lutheran parent. She's Quaker, going to go to Lutheran seminary. Typically crazy, mixed-up seminarian, like all the others and like all of us. That is, you don't have pure strands of unsheltered traditions around very much anymore, thanks to intermarriage and mobility and so on. And so we have to ask something about what it might be within a tradition to sense this for Harriet and me this month, the jarring of this Salzburg, where you can go into the cathedral and the sacred is there, borne by the music of Mozart. Wow, woo. Right at the edge of the profane, by the way. I always think he just takes opera and changes the words to Agnus Dei. But, wow. I have a little trouble with Salzburg because the Catholic bishop, father of 12 children, and his Spanish mistress who built the building we were staying in, kicked the Lutherans out of Salzburg to Georgia. But the sacred is manifest. You can't miss it. And then we go to China, and we go to little places where somebody comes in a little joss stick and says a little prayer all by themselves or meditates. It's not mine, but I can sense something is going on here that wants to transcend the boundaries of ordinary life. Pointless, but significant, as we approach the sacred. Since I began with Annie Dillard, and I just a moment ago said, I think, therefore, we should be extremely attentive to what goes on. She has something wonderful somewhere in her writings about this. She says of sloppy worship, of worship inattentive to the presence and the sacred, worship that doesn't know boundary and limit and reach. She says, why is it that we who've been at this for 2,000 years can't do something up front as well as an average amateur, small town, high school, senior class in a play they rehearse 6 weeks? That's kind of a little judgment on us. I mean, there's an attentiveness. There are people who know and there are ways to do. The play can be boring or it can be exciting. It can fail or not, but you know they have worked at it. I have a son here who one morning was driving me to church, and I think we talked a little bit about why I was nervous. I preach about every 5 or 6 weeks. I'm a little bit nervous before a lecture. I'm terribly nervous Monday. Tuesday, I'm a little less afraid of you. By last night, you all looked like friends. Today, I can be casual. Lecturing is one thing. Teaching is one thing. Preaching is very different for me. And why? Well, if I have nightmares or eczema or diarrhea or other occupational diseases of speakers, did you ever know, according to the polls, that the greatest fear Americans have, they tell the poll taker, is public speaking? Not death, but public speaking, which is a lot like it. We're on the way to church. Why nervous then? Why nervous then? Well, with a lecture, I always say the worst thing you can do is bomb, and they'll be mad at the committee that invited you. David and Karen. You know, you can always get after them if you don't like the program. And we leave, and we don't get invited back, but nothing's really hurt except 45 minutes of your time. But worship. I just try to imagine. She has been beat up for years, and just once she's going to give a chance at a different message. They got engaged, and they have a joy that they just have to share. This one's curious, and they're going to see what happens. This one is lured by the music, and it better be as good as that culture can produce that day. The weight of what people bring when they're going to put themselves in the zone of the sacred is a very different kind of thing. Again, that's why I'm saying that amateur, lay, professional, whatever, attentiveness to this is extremely important. Isaac Stern, one night before he went on to play the violin, was fretting away and, you know, backstage nervousness. Somebody said, you've done this 3,000 times. Never with this audience. And just this morning, I was reading a 25th anniversary of the year 1968 in Sports Illustrated. A wonderful profile of Joe DiMaggio, and somebody said, why did he give all every game? Nothing new to prove. Yanks could be ahead 22 games. Everybody who came never forgot the day they saw DiMaggio, and he said, because I'm playing in front of some people today who never did see me before and never will again. I think that kind of attentiveness is scary. I mean, nobody should be scarier than the people who have to do it. Take off the shoes from your feet because you're on holy ground. And when do we do it? We do it to honor the rites of passage. How marvelous last night that we had a family and the baptism and a pastor who I think interpreted in this culture, an ad hoc culture, only an eighth of a line of hilarity after announcing it. He knew that to do too much deprives baptism, but to do it as if we had the smells and adolescent rites for marriage, for burial, or the times and seasons, we set them aside. In a moment, I'll talk about why we do. Events, classic events, the kind you can't get behind, Jacob and Abraham and Amos and Jesus. Classic events. Walter Harrelson says that Israel took all the Canaanite festivals, that were seasonal nature festivals, and made them history events. Passover. Christians did the same thing. Jesus wasn't born on December 25th. Well, he might have been. The odds are 1 in 365 that he was. But we don't know anything at all. But there was an awfully pagan festival around there at the end of the year. And it would be nice to stamp it out. So we do that. Easter is a little better hit. But what we're really doing is taking a festival called Ostre, which is pagan. And we connect it with our solstice and rising. We impose events because we celebrate them along the way. The sense of the presence. The sacred presence. And we try to see to it that something happens there. I'm not talking much about the act of preaching. I talked about autobiography of why it scares me to do so. But that is one of the elements that does evoke the sacred. When you listen to or for the sacred, you listen to the words that are freshly evoked for that community, that day, out of one of these classic texts. I read 40 years ago an essay by a German theologian that sounds like horrible syntax, but it has the point. When the preaching of the word occurs, something really happens. It does not not happen. Something really happens. My professor of preaching always had us run around and say, is this preacher describing God or offering God? Describing God is what you do in the classroom. Offering God is there's an enactment at that moment. That's what we mean by the sense of the sacred being present, and the sacraments are the same kind of thing. You are in the range of the presence, in the range of the presence. Many people here probably remember the name of Joe Sittler, one of my mentors, a late and great blind but far-seeing theologian who once made the point about pointlessness. He said, there's only one thing that the believing community, he included Jews, he could have done others, but what the believing Christian community, only one thing they do that others don't do, and that is praise. Anybody, he said, this is back when you had mimeograph machines instead of duplicating desktop publishing. Anybody can have a mimeograph machine and turn stuff out. Anybody can have a committee. Anybody can do good things in the city. A lot of them do a lot better than church. Anybody can have therapies. Anybody can do all those things. The only thing that this community decisively does distinctively is praise. Acknowledgement of the source. Now, as an individual, you can praise in the face of the mountain or the daffodil or the other beautiful things we've talked about here this week. But for setting up a circumstance, this is what we do. And we do it knowing how dangerous it is. You can overdo it and make it banal. And I have friends, former friends, every time you pick up the phone, praise the Lord. Well, all right, praise the Lord. I mean, have a good day. They mean well, and I shouldn't just trivialize it, but you can trivialize things by overdoing them and just making them that routine. So worship is between the structure of conjuring this and then making it just enough different each time. I have a little bit of a personal aesthetic peeve against the word just when we're in the range of the sacred. Well, Lord, I just want to chat with you a little while. Lord, I just want to know if you had a little bit of time for me, just little old me, Lord. I just well meant. It preserves the conversational mode, but I don't know where that otherness and the beyondness is along the way. So now I'm coming down the home stretch. Why do some of us think it's important for taking what I talked about last night, the recovery of the sacred in healing, and the day before, the danger of the sacred in human relations? Why is that important now in that act of life where we most consistently set ourselves up for this? And I'm going to rely here a little bit on two writers. One is in the book I tried to sell the first day on the sacred. John Smith wrote a book, an essay called The Experience of the Holy and the Idea of God. And the other is Jerome Miller, who wrote a book called The Way of Suffering. So if I'm highly attentive here, it's because in the post-Biden era, you're very careful about your sources, plagiarism. I learned a lot from them. John Smith. The sacred means the set apart from the ordinary. It brings to us the sense of the awe-inspiring, the dangerous, the precious, that which should be approached with seriousness and gravity. Whereas the profane is the immediately open, manifest, obvious, ordinary, and thus devoid of the power to evoke awe and reverence. And the theory here is that we humans are better off. For our relations to each other, for our recovery of our own self-esteem, our situating of ourselves, if regularly, at stages of our life, times of the year, times of the week, times of the day, we situate ourselves in the presence of the other. John Smith says, where all is ordinary, open, manifest, and devoid of either depth or majesty, awe and reverence disappear and are replaced by boredom and indifference. We set aside places. How many of you have visited the Vietnam Memorial? There's a real sense, isn't there, of awe. Wherever you stood on the Vietnamese War, you look at 59,000 names in that rally. And you walk over to Lincoln Memorial. This is a secular religion, if you will. Just trying to say there is a space set aside. Any of us could think those thoughts, but we don't think those thoughts unless we are in the places where those thoughts get set up. As John Smith says, we just don't talk about those things in other audiences, like the football game. Football game may be mighty serious and might be a lot of fun, but it's not the place where we situate ourselves this way. Britta Stendhal. They've been up here. I've seen Christer Stendhal's writings here as a mentor, and she does some wonderful writing. They had a sabbatical back in the Holy Land, Sweden, after having spending time in profane Harvard. And she told about how worship had sort of slipped for her for some years, and she got back in the churches of her childhood, and she said, not always did that sermon ring. Not always did everything work right, but I situated myself in a space where I heard these texts, and I would then conjure up what this meant. We set apart from the ordinary for the sake of the ordinary. You go back down into it. We tell the stories. We don't just have the generalized sacred, but we have the sacred that's touched by Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Isaiah, Jesus. It needs interpreting in a sense in our life, and that's why we use story along the way. Jerome Miller, in a late chapter in his book called The Way of Suffering, a book that I don't have up here for sale, but I commend to you, The Way of Suffering, says if we live life only on the ordinary level, never insignificant in the face of the sacred, never prostrating ourselves, then we live, quote, in the tight, airless room of our own egocentricity. We need upset. Paul Ricoeur, a philosopher who's taught a lot of us to do some biblical interpretation, reminds us, and think about it, no biblical parable can achieve its work until it upsets. The gospel words of Jesus are that the last shall be first, and the first last. The uninvited get in, and the invited don't come. The people under the balcony get to the head table, and the proud of the head table get set back. The littlest seed becomes the biggest tree. The lost is found. Everything is reversal, because God can only work when there's a reversal of our ordinary way of thinking about things. Always look for that. So Jerome Miller says, to do justice, we first have to have shuddered. He says, height is the position we always seek in the geography of the heart. Last night I was talking about how hard it is to heal when the healer has to be in control and dominating and managing. The body can't heal until we hear the voice of illness. Height is the position we always seek, but worship doesn't start us with the height. And he says what we get out of the best worship is a sense of the excruciating catharsis, cleaning out. Because the heart is finally free to express the cry which it has struggled so long to keep suppressed. You get to say things with the Psalms and in the hymns and at the river and around the font and the table and near the campfire, you get to say things about yourself and your dreams and your hopes that you long suppressed in that egocentricity that was there. Worship, says Jerome Miller, is the unconditional surrender which, according to the religious person, must be reserved for the ultimately sacred, for that other, which in our culture is called God. And what worship always says of the sacred is simply that nothing can be beyond it, superior to it, that it is, as it were, the absolute beyond, beyond which there is no beyond. In its presence, all things other than the ultimately sacred evaporate. And here's what I think he thinks, and I agree with him. Such worship, such positioning near the sacred that is awesome, can do for us. Why we have a holy day, quote, a day reserved for addressing the sacred, is never meant to be simply another day. And you know how unportable a day is. Some of you were here earlier this week when we had Christmas in July at Holden. We really do pretty well at it. It didn't feel one bit like Christmas. It felt like Christmas in July at Holden Village. Right? It's a nice try, folks, but it's not portable. There's a whole gestalt, a whole connotation, a whole advent has to lead up to it, all those things. You can't just come in sweaty from volleyball and suddenly have Christmas. We can evoke it because every worship service is Christmas. Same thing with Easter. Baptism, every baptism is an Easter service, but it ain't the same as when the lilies are there and the trumpets are there and the Lent has preceded it and so on. We set aside. They're not simply another day. So this is how Miller ends it. What is characteristic of the religious heart is not that it renounces its self-centeredness, but precisely that it renounces its self-centeredness not just without melancholy or regret, but with unrestrained ardor. Repentance is usually pictured as a pretty grim thing, isn't it? You know that every New Testament picture of repentance is joyful. Why are you wearing long faces? When the bridegroom is present, why is everybody sitting around that table so grim, Jesus says? New wine, new bottles. You get to get rid of what you were. You're not merely renouncing self-centeredness. Anybody can do that. But in the face of the sacred, you do so without melancholy or regret, but with unrestrained ardor. Now listen, the religious heart no longer takes its desires seriously enough to mourn their loss. I wish I'd written that sentence, so I'm going to repeat it at least, so you'll think I did. The religious heart no longer takes its desires seriously enough to mourn their loss. For this reason, real worship is always celebrative. Indeed, there must always be in it something frankly uninhibited. The sacred deserves nothing less than our being boundlessly happy before it. You didn't think it was going to end up here, did you? I got your shoes off your feet on holy ground. I got you all scared of the holy going to evaporate. I got you all groveling in repentance. And all of a sudden we find out that all worship has about it the breaking of the bounds of the old egocentric self, because we've met the other as well as we can in the human circumstances of setting this up. That's why I think it's so important that our worship have something of this character. What I didn't do this morning was to do half of the talk, namely the private prayer, A, because I'm not as good at it, and B, because everything I'd have to say is analogous to what I'd say about the public one. But I am going to do what I'm supposed to do every day, and this is the one I get 15 cents worth of royalties out of. The others are, I don't. Whatever I have thought through about active private prayer is in a little book up here called A Cry of Absence, Reflections for the Winter of the Heart, illustrations by daughter-in-law Susan Toymer Marty, who is here tending three kids. So it's another family venture. It's written after the death of my first wife. It's not autobiography. It's the spiritual reflection that grew out of it. And it's written for the people who, which is everybody, I hope, have times of what the Catholic theologian calls the winter of the heart. It seems to me so many books of prayer are for sunny, summery things. Oh, is it really nice and easy? You get up here in the morning, it's all great. And then you get out here and it's drizzling and you wonder. And the heart has these things too. And I think that the sacred can come not only in the sense of the presence that I've talked about this morning, but in the sense of the absence, when God seems silent and remote, and when sometimes our best worship is silence or letting a psalm work on us along the way. So I didn't talk a lot about that, but whatever I know about it is in there. Many of you asked about the title of last night's book, I Shot Past Too Fast. It's also up there. Arthur Frank, F-R-A-N-K, At the Will of the Body. 44 minutes and 23 seconds. I'm a couple seconds early today, so have we things to say back and forth on sacred time, sacred space, sacred event? Yes, please. Okay, when a genius comes along, I may not like the geniuses I'm talking about. I call them the four bearded God killers. Oh, the question. What did I mean when I said a classic is something you can't get behind once you're aware of it? An event or a person, author. People I call the four bearded God killers of the 19th century, spill over the 20th, Darwin, Marx, Nietzsche, and Freud. You can't get behind them. For centuries, people talk in vague terms, or they have a sense of an apprehension when they look out the window that social class has something to do with ideology and outlook. When the liberation theology says God has a preferential option for the poor, they are combining Bible and Marx. Because if you just look out the window, I have a colleague, Robin Levin, who did a paper once on a playful paper on God's preferential option for the rich, because you look out there, he sure looks like they're being favored, right? But along comes somebody who says, this has to be overturned. For Marx, through violent revolution, through the prophets and Jesus, through attentiveness to justice. Once that's gathered up, these centuries, and said, you can revise, but you can't get back behind. You can't be. People always knew that the stories that go into our childhood, our toilet training, our what's that old man doing in mom's bedroom? I mean, everybody knew that was kind of a little bugging people. And along comes this strange Viennese Jew named Freud, who got almost everything wrong, I think. Moses and monotheism is his great statement on religion, based on a theory about how the Israelites had to kill off Moses. And the guy who wrote that a few years later says to Freud, whoops, I did more research, there's nothing to it. Freud said, never mind, it's the right kind of myth we need for it. You know, if you want to be literal about it, but once he said it, our therapies, our Christian therapy, we all know he's there. And so once it's happened, maybe my best illustration for this comes from the world of architecture, modern architecture. We're now postmodern. Modern architecture, the simple skyscraper style. A story of some years ago, the Bronfman family of Canada, Seagram whiskey people, wanted to build the normative skyscraper of the modern era in New York. It's called the Seagram Building. Many of you may have seen it. It's a great building in its style. And it happened that one of the Bronfmans was studying at the Illinois Institute of Technology. She was studying architecture, and Dad wrote and said, go talk to everybody, not just at your school, but everywhere, and ask what are the 10 greatest firms in the country to build skyscrapers. And then he wrote a letter to the top 10 nominees. I.M. Pei said, well, now I would, Mies van der Rohe does this kind of thing, and I've learned from him, but I tend to have angles in my buildings. And Yamasaki says, I have a Japanese lyricism. I soften these things a little bit. And Mies van der Rohe is too severe. There were 12. 11 of the 12 mentioned what they would do in relation to what Mies van der Rohe would do. So the old man said, I better get Mies van der Rohe. He must be the normative one. Well, today you don't want to build Mies style anymore, but you can't get behind it. You know that the modern was stated that way, and the postmodern is variations and deconstructions of that. And that's where I think the Christian stories get to be a part of our lives so that when we confront the sacred in the mountain, it's one form, and we take our interpretations from it. And I can't say enough for it, or in poetry, or in music. But in the act of a believing community's coming together, it's the particular story that gives shape to our life. It happened, it did not happen. Is that helpful? Okay. Please. No, it's fair, but it doesn't come out the first 45 minutes. It happens when you go back to your little church where the 20 people are. It goes back to the place where you pray. I'm assuming a kind of a pluralism that's hard to be prescriptive. I could give a few outlines. I can't picture a completed worship without some dimension of music. Because music, we all know, is that form that pushes to the boundlessness. You can't capture it. The note before is gone. It eases into the next. It leans onto the next. It breaks bounds. It allows us to think a lot of different thoughts along the way. It situates us. It is beautiful, and worship should be beautiful. I don't think it's normally completed without some scripture, because we are a committee gathered around particular stories and not just feeling good and oozy. But beyond that, I guess my own sense is that we do best when we see what is around of a tradition and then see how we work out of that into the world that's around us. In the second 45 minutes, I would say some things I think are a problem. I think that in our own time, I use the word just as an example, the notion that all worship should be chummy chatty. Now, worship should have the breakthrough. That's what the passing of the peace does. It reminds us that we're fellow sweaty human beings, and that's important in worship. These things first happened in somebody's living room 2,000 years ago. We have to keep some of that mood. We shouldn't worry too much about a kid crying, because there probably were kids crying in the living room back there. I am very disturbed in our time by the market mentality in worship, the mega mall notion, that you take an assessment of what precisely the people who aren't of the believing community think they want, and you adapt to it, and you never move beyond it, because what they want is not the sacred. They want to be catered to. Now, I'm glad when churches haul people in. It's nice to have it happen. But I think we've been oversold on the notion that you do an opinion poll, and then you market it right back. It's a funny thing to say, but if they've been living a completely profane existence, what do they know about it? Whereas that 16-year-old kid who's born again and has got his guitar knows something, at least. And that organist knows something, at least. And this choir that's been singing more or less on key knows something, at least. The tenders of it. You can never let the tradition alone. We don't live where people lived a little while ago. But I think the notion that the assessment of what people have already heard at the mall determines what goes on in the sanctuary would be a limit. So I'd say be aware of the mall people, but then you bring them to the sanctuary. I like to see expositions of traditions. Music, art where possible, often living art. I often rather have the right thing by a little kid up front that evokes something fresh than I would a pale reproduction of old style pink and green Jesus and the lilies and the shepherds. Prayer, let me just mention one as a sample, and then I have to see one more hand it. Intercessory prayer, I think is a big deal. And we had a Eucharist the other night. I think it's very hard to complete a large act of worship without intercessory prayer. William May, a Presbyterian theologian and Southern Methodist, wrote a wonderful thing on the public meanings of worship. And he stressed this. What does this have to do? And this leads into tomorrow's thing a little bit about the significance leading to justice. He said, at least three good things happen in intercessory prayer. One, there is no immediate local need too petty to bring to the believing community's attention. We have a list of people in our congregation we pray for every week, and some of them aren't as bad off as I am that day, but they feel it, and therefore they are. And you'll hear that Aunt Esther is going in for surgery. I don't know who Aunt Esther is, but she's important to the one who's there. Or someone will say, I want the prayers of this congregation to help me through a particular temptation. I don't dare butt in to find out what that temptation is. We have healing services, and I see a couple going forward, and they're tears and beautiful tears. Well, I know that it's infertility. Well, in our house, they came too fast. But this is a big, big deal. And she should pray it. He should pray it. So nothing is too trivial to be brought into the sacred place. Secondly, says Bill May, it's the place where you make the invisible visible. We read the newspaper headlines about the homeless. We're aware that the little kids in Iraq are also bombed when we bomb the defense industries there. But I've watched, and I really made a study. I did everything I could after this Desert Storm. Most of the churches had been against armed intervention, and a week later, any minister who prayed the wrong prayer would be run out on a rail. What did they pray? They kept praying for Iraqi children. They kept all of these humane sides that get overlooked in the play of power before them. You make people visible who would be unnoticed otherwise. And third, the enemy. The prayer isn't complete unless we remember that not everybody is in the circle. There is the other, the excluded, the hostile, the one who would kill us or whatever, and it's never complete without it. Now, by bringing those three things, which are generalized impulses, we all know we should do these things, into the place where there's a place set aside and a moment set aside for it. Somebody defines intercessory prayer as loving your neighbor on your knees. But then you get up and you're supposed to be different toward the world from it. So I think fulfilling worship includes this kind of prayer. Finally, back row. Oh, we got two finallys. I'll do them quickly. The role of the World Council of Churches in relation to this kind of topic. Well, first of all, it did an awful lot. I'm going to talk about 1911 to 1965, I think, is a chapter in ecumenism, with the World Council formation 1948 as a big symbolic event. We don't live in that era anymore. But from 1911 to 1965, a meeting of the World Missionary Conference of Edinburgh through the Second Vatican Council, the main thing that Christians were doing ecumenically is saying, is Christ divided by our denominations? And we had better start finding a common language. And the World Council was the most inclusive element to bring what was then called the younger churches in range with the European churches that had just been through two wars, at a great time, a great theological, biblical, liturgical renewal, and so on. Bring these languages together. You could hear it at Vancouver a few years ago. You still do it. But I think in many respects, it gave birth to bigger things than it was. And so to a lot of people, it's just an element. It's a little bit boring, right? It still does a lot of good things, but it's not where it is, because what happened? Well, here comes the Pope. And I think Catholic, non-Catholic ecumenism is very exciting, and they can't be in the World Council. So I don't want to do something that limits my contact. On one issue, I'm going to be closer to a Catholic than to a fellow Lutheran or other Protestants. And on another issue, when Cardinal Ratzinger speaks up, I want the whole mafia, from the Quakers to the Baptists to everybody on my side against him. Right? I'm just trying to talk about that. Ecumenism is now a spirit that has kind of an ad hoc character. And I think the World Council, I was at the 1960 Central Committee, and I'll never forget, I was a press person, they were formulating, I was enjoying it, a formulation of what Christian unity should look like. Many of you may know the formula, that all in each place who are baptized and called in the name of Christ should form a fully committed fellowship, dot, dot, dot. And the typist from Geneva brought it out to the press room, and that beautiful phrase, you should form a fully committed fellowship, became a full committee fellowship. And I think that was the mentality that's been a problem in the councils. They need our help, but they're not where it is. In worship, they've done a great deal. You have to remember this, the most ecumenical part of the life of the church for most people, including radically sectarian people, is their hymn book. People who won't pray with somebody else will sing the hymns they wrote, right? And that's gone on a long time. I mean, we sing hymns by that radical modernist, Harry Emerson Fosdick, and they sing hymns by St. Ambrose.